First off, I would like to thank everyone for coming today. The title of this lecture is called Please Let This Be My Child, Ovarian Transplants and Maternity in Jewish Law, A New Approach. And essentially, this lecture came from something that was bothering me. When I first gave the shiur on the sugya of ovarian transplants or on maternity in Jewish law, at the end of the day, after I gave the lecture, there was something bothering me. There was something there that just didn't feel right, something that was upsetting me, but I couldn't necessarily place my finger on it. Then I was sitting in my reproductive ethics class in my master's program here, and we were discussing the bioethical perspectives of maternity. And it was there that I started to begin to understand what was really bothering me about the halachic response, or the lack thereof in the discussion. And so therefore, when Rabbi Tzinensky approached me about asking me if there was something that we should talk about, I said, yes, I have something that's bothering me that maybe you can maybe help me figure out. And it was there that we decided to take a fresh look, a different perspective at this topic. And hopefully what you have before you will be just that. So as with any good medical school lecture, I always like to open with cases. I find cases are good, something A, we can refer back to, and B, just to help us really make this more real. So what's our first case? Our first case is Chana. Chana is a 24-year-old who suffered from leukemia as a young child. Her treatment, while successful and life-saving, unfortunately left her infertile. Doctors have told her over the years that she will never be able to have a child, something that is extremely painful for a woman to hear, for anyone to hear. She's now happily married and would like to have a child that she can call her own. The doctor suggests an egg donation. From a Jewish perspective, can Chana, when she comes to you as the rabbi, even as a doctor, will Chana be able to call this child her own? And the second case is really just a little bit of a twist, but a fascinating twist on the first, on our case, and which may or may not have be the same. What if instead of suggesting an egg donation, the physicians suggested to Chana something that only came into existence in the last 6 to 8 weeks, that before now wouldn't even know existed, wouldn't even think it was possible, something called an ovarian stem cell transplant? What if the doctors came to Chana and said, we'd like to, why don't you do an ovarian stem cell transplant? Would Chana be able to call that child her own? Because Chana really wants to be the mother of the resulting child. When she comes to you, she has this plea. Please let this be my child. So our question today is, how can halacha respond to this plea? So the usual halachic discussions often center around either birth or genetic. It's either the birth mother or the genetic mother. And today we want to suggest a third dimension, which is not usually discussed, but which can have monumental implications. And in order to appreciate this flow, the way we've broken up today's lecture is, first, I will go through some of the medical, ethical issues regarding both egg donation and ovarian transplants and stem cell transplants. We'll give a little bit of a historical background. Then we'll do a little bit of the halachic analysis, the usual halachic analysis. We'll then have some of the bioethical analysis. And then ultimately, we will conclude with the halachic response to the bioethical analysis. So let us begin with the classic discussion of the egg donor. So egg donation first came into existence, really, in 1984. 1984 was the first time that we successfully had a live birth. Sorry about that. We successfully had a live birth, and this was in UCLA in February of 1984. And that's the reason why we only really start seeing tshuvos regarding this topic around that time. So how is IVF done? So IVF is done. So take a look at your handout over here. So basically, in this nice bright picture, how is IVF done? What we do is we take some hormones, we give the woman the hormones, we get her cycle all together, we get her ovaries to make as many eggs as possible, we go in, we retrieve the eggs, we then put them in the lab, we mix the sperm and the egg, we get the embryo fertilized, and then when everything is just right, we put the fertilized embryo back into the woman. Now, why is this done? So it's usually done, egg donation is done for people who are having trouble or who cannot conceive. So what are examples of that? So it could be either one category, people who don't have eggs. So for example, Chana, our case with Chana. Chana is someone who unfortunately does not have any eggs. Her ovaries have been destroyed. Or someone who could have premature ovarian failure, in which case her ovaries no longer work. And that's a case we'll see brought down in the New England Journal of Medicine. The other category of people is people who can't carry a pregnancy. So I have eggs. This woman has eggs, but she can't carry it. Either she doesn't have a uterus, for whatever reason, or she is too dangerous for her to carry a pregnancy, or she's unfortunately had multiple miscarriages with no successful pregnancy. So those are the situations in which we would actually do it. So now let's move on a little bit to ovarian transplants. So what is an ovarian transplant? What's ovarian stem cell transplants? Are they actually done? When were they done? So ovarian transplants are something so fascinating because they are both cutting edge, something that's occurring on the cutting edge of medical research in 2012, and historical, something that happened at the end of the 19th century. And as fanciful as this sounds, this fascinating idea, is it actually done? You know, oftentimes we talk about theoretical things, but are ovarian transplants actually performed? And so the answer is not so much. Even though we started doing it a very long time ago, it wasn't so successful then. There were a lot of issues with it. You had to take anti-rejection drugs. So we didn't really do it that much. And then when egg donation came around, we basically almost completely forgot about ovarian transplants because egg donation was so much better. However, recently, ovarian transplants have come back into the news. So, for example, you can see here in New England Journal of Medicine in March 2007, this is where this was twin sisters, one of which had premature ovarian failure. So, what her sister tried to get pregnant so many times with IVF, but kept failing. So, finally, they did, since they were identical twins, they were able to do an ovarian transplant. And as you can see here, this is actually how we do the ovarian transplant, right below that. And she successfully gave birth, her sister successfully gave birth to a baby girl. However, most often ovarian transplants are actually done to preserve fertility. So if Chana were to come to us today with this question, with this problem, we would have answered her and said, why don't we do ovarian preservation? We would have preserved her ovaries. But that's not something we're necessarily going to talk about here. So just so we understand exactly what happens in an ovarian transplant. So with a regular ovarian transplant, what we're doing is we are transplanting another woman's tissue. The ovarian tissue that contains the eggs and the follicles into Chana. We are taking another woman's eggs, putting that into Chana. So what's this new breakthrough that I talked about? So merely 6 to 8 weeks ago, in fact, February 26, 2012, in Nature, as you can see here on your right, there was a breakthrough in our understanding of medicine. And below it, I also, the New York Times article. So what happened? What was this? So researchers in Mass General and in Japan discovered something that went against our complete understanding of how the ovaries worked. We always thought that every woman who was born with the total number of eggs she would ever have in her life, and those eggs rapidly would die throughout her lifetime. But what these researchers found was something called an ovarian stem cell. They found that it's not that you're born with everything, but we can create eggs from these stem cells. And they did. They created eggs from these stem cells. So now the question is, we now have the possibility of transplanting not the other woman's eggs, but just cells. I can take cells from one woman, put them in another woman, and grow That woman, Chana, can now grow her own eggs. So would that change the halachic response? So on the one hand, it's incredibly novel, right? Something that you could say just 6 to 8 weeks old. But on the other hand, ovarian transplant, the field of ovarian transplant, first occurred in 1895, 80 to 100 years before egg donations. So in 1895, when they first did this, there were no successful births. However, one woman did get pregnant, she unfortunately miscarried, and one resumed menstruation. In 1902, Dr. Robert Morris performed a surgery where he removed his patient's ovaries and took some ovarian tissue from another woman and put it in this woman. 4 years later, as you can see here, the original medical record that announced this, on May 5th, 1906, Dr. Robert Morris made medical history when his patient delivered a live baby girl, the first from an ovarian transplant. Now, at that time, there was a lot of discussion in the secular literature. First of all, they didn't even believe that he had done this. They didn't believe that this was true. It didn't even make sense. And we'll actually see a little bit of that reflection in the halachic discussion. And this, even if he had performed with this procedure, the next question that was discussed in the literature was, well, who's the mother now? Is it the ovarian donor, or is it the one who gave birth? Now, it's interesting because at this point, they did know about the eggs. They had seen sperm and eggs from the 1600s, but they didn't really understand genetics. Remember, Mendel's famous genetics work wasn't really that well known at this point. They didn't know exactly what eggs did. They knew it contributed somehow, but they weren't also sure what the gestational mother contributed as well. So interestingly enough, they had three different options. One was, it's the birth mother. Once you remove the eggs from the ovarian tissue from the first woman, we forget about that first woman. The other one said, no, clearly there's some contribution here from the first woman. And a third fascinating option, which was, just look at the child. If the child looks like the birth mother, then that's the mother. The child looks like the ovarian donor, then that's the mother. Now, at the same time, within the year after this medical breakthrough happened, remember, in those days things moved a lot slower. We didn't have the internet. You didn't have digital versions of anything. So the only way to know about something is to actually see it or hear about it. And news traveled a lot slower back then. In 1907, you can turn to your next page, Rabbi Yaakov Gordon posed an open question to the readers of a Hungarian journal, Vilakit Yosef. And we'll read here what he actually said. So take a look here. You can see the original journal on your left. He says, "Atzia bezesh she'elash nistapakti lehalacha." I got a question. "Harofim himtziu po tachbula lehoshiv klei leida me'isha." The doctors here have done something remarkable. They were able to take out the clay leda of one woman and put it into another woman, and she was able to have a child. And you skip down to the bottom line. He says, "And therefore I said, you know what? Let me ask this question in Vilaket Yosef. Umiyo dea peter daver. Does anyone know what the answer is here? I don't even know." Now, the first thing I want to point out, and the reason why I showed you this, was what was his question? His question actually uses the word klei leda mi'isha. And if I were to go around this room right now and ask every person, what do you think klei leda mean? I'm fairly certain we would get different responses. The reason why I point this out is to show you, because when we then look at the halachic responses that came back, we're going to get wildly different views and wildly different discussions, because this question was ambiguous. Because the medical understanding at the time was even ambiguous. And that's why it's so important to place all these responses into the medical historical background to make sure that we fully understand the response. And this is precisely where the interface between doctors and rabbis can be so important. Understanding the medical and historical background that these tshuvos were written. So over the next few years, Rabbi Gordon received varying responses, like I said, with very different understandings of what actually happened. Rabbi Deitch, for example, he thought that what actually happened here was that the actual external genitalia of the woman was transplanted. Therefore, he has a wildly different discussion about something called erva. Another response, and there were a bunch of other responses. Now, it's important to understand that when these rabbis were trying to figure out the answer to this question, nothing like this had ever existed before. So the rabbis had to search for something analogous in our rich history. There's no discussion in the Torah of an ovarian transplant. There's no discussion even in the Gemara of an ovarian transplant. So when they were first presented with this, they had to really search long and hard to try to come up with sources that they could use. So let's look at one of these responses. One of the responses I have here is the Evan Yekara, and the reason why I chose it is because it's the backbone, it'll be the backbone that we will discuss that for the Tzitz Eliezer's understanding. So let's look at the Evan Yekara. First of all, if you look here, he says, if you scan down to the second underlined area, Kiani rachok libi lahamin lekol hashemu azaz. I don't even believe this question. You're telling me, right? He quotes the same question from the Vilaket Yosef, and he says, I'm not even sure this actually happened, because this just sounds crazy. But he says, whatever, you know what, let's say it did happen. Who is the mother of the child? Skip down. He says, Avlad hu ben shel hashnia. It's the birth mother. Why? What's the makor? What did he look at when he searched high and low through halacha? What area of halacha did he use as a basis for his decision? Listen carefully. V'amakor haniftach lahalacha zu la'anias daiti, the place that I found this, is something brought, hamavura b'shas, it's brought in the Gemara Sota, yolda shesimka b'zikena le'inyan arla. My proof for my understanding of who the mother is comes from agricultural law. Agricultural law! That's where he found a proof. So what was this proof? So take a look on your left. I have the Gemara here. Yolda shesimcha b'zikena. What is yolda shesimcha b'zikena? So yolda is where you take regarding arla, right? You can't eat the fruits for a certain amount of time. A young tree, right, when you first plant it, you can't eat its fruits for the first couple of years. So what if we took a young tree and we grafted it on, shesibcha b'zikena, we grafted it on to an older tree. And that branch that we had just grafted now sprouts fruit. Can I eat those fruits? Because if it was from the original tree, if we considered this branch part of the original tree, you can't eat that fruit because it's too young. But if it's considered part of the tree that was grafted on, you would be able to eat those fruits. What is the Gemara answer? Batla yolda l'zikena. The yelda, the younger one, becomes batal to the older one, the ein ba din arla, and you can eat that fruit. So therefore, the Evan Yekara comes and says to us, it's the same thing here. When I take this, the ovaries from one woman, and I graft it, right? It's very analogous. I implant it. Similar agricultural word? Don't know. That was intentional or not. I implant it now in the second woman. It's considered completely batal, completely belongs to the second woman. And therefore, he feels in this case it should be, the child should belong to the second woman. Interestingly enough, there's even a machlokus, whether we can even use agricultural texts to apply to humans, but that's not something we're necessarily going to go into further. Anyone who is interested can look online. We do have other shiurim that focus more on each one of these topics. So coming back to Chana, how do we answer Chana's question? When she comes to you, the rabbi, the doctor, she wants to know, can I call this my child? What? What do we answer her? So, is this even halachically permissible? So there's a lot of discussion whether one can even do egg donation. Rav Yashiv, Rav Bransdorfer, Chabad, they all felt it was usur because they're concerned about yichus, ambiguity, right? We're concerned. Shema Yisa Basachoso. For more information on that, you can listen to other previous shiurim. But essentially, we don't want people marrying their brother and sister. So therefore, we're concerned that if we use egg donation and the resultant child belongs to the egg donor, maybe that woman donated her eggs to a bunch of other people. And then when this child grows up, he or she might end up marrying his or her halachic brother and sister. So therefore, they felt you shouldn't do it. There's actually a whole discussion with what Rabbi Yashiv actually holds. Rav Zalman Nechemiah Goldberg, from whom I've received some smicha from, he says technically it's permissible. He says it might not necessarily be the best thing. Rav Eliyahu, Rav Avadya, Rav Gedalia Schwartz, Rav David Cohn, Rav Belsky, Rav Willig, they all say that you can do this, that this is in fact permissible. However, we generally only try to do this in extreme circumstances. We don't usually rush to egg donations unless it's absolutely necessary. Fine. But who is the mother? When Chana comes to you, who is the mother? And why do we care? So the one of the reasons why we care is because who is considered the halachic mother has some ramifications. For Yichus, right? Who inherits? Is this child Jewish? Who can this child marry or not? Does it need a conversion? Lots of different things. That's the reason why we ask the question. Now, how do we define motherhood? Okay, so who is it? At the end of the day, when you've done an egg donation, who's the mother of this child? So there's, as with just about anything in halacha, there's a machlokas. So as we've gone through in depth elsewhere, basically, which I'll summarize quickly here. So according to Rav Eliyashiv, which is quoted in the Encyclopedia Hilchatit Rifuit, the Encyclopedia of Jewish Medical Ethics, and the Nishmas Avram, he holds it's the birth mother, it's the gestational mother that is the child. In addition to Zalman Nechemiah Goldberg, Rav Kilav, Rav Shaul Yisraeli, Rav Eliyahu, the Tzitz Eliezer, in Yud Ches Mem Tes, Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz, they all hold that it is in fact the mother that actually gives birth to this child, is the child. So Chana, if she got eggs from someone else, she could call this child her child. Fine. However, there are some Rabbanim who say, no, it's the egg donor. It's the genetics. Rav Yaakov Ariel, Rav Vosner, Rav Nevensal, Rav Gorin, there's even some, Rav Avadya Yosef, and there's even a machlokas maybe that says that they feel that Rav Eliyashiv actually was on this side of the debate, that it was the egg donor. And then you have Suffolk, you have Rav Zalman Nechemiah Goldberg, a huge person in the field of Jewish medical ethics, and the Mincha Shlomo, he says, you know what? Almost everything I've found an answer to. This question of egg donation, of who's the mother, I cannot find an answer in the Gemara. I don't know. Therefore, he says, it's a suffix. It's a suffix, we have to presume that it could possibly be both the egg donor and the birth mother. In addition, Rav Herschel Schechter told me on a personal conversation that he also felt it was a suffix as well. And there even are some people who hold that they feel that maybe there are no parents in this case. There's one Tshuva, the Tzitz Eliezer, that a lot of different published articles point to regarding that. And another interesting thing is, if you take a look, you'll notice that, in fact, the pendulum has seemed to have begun to swing. In particular, there's a machlokas, there's an argument about what Rav Eliyashiv held, whether he changed his mind or not. So there is this really is still a huge discussion. And that's why, when Chana comes to you, it's not clear what the answer is. And if she falls down on the side, right, if the rabbi that she asks holds its genetics, then the child that she has, this child that Chana is giving birth to from an egg donation, is not her child. It would seem it's not her child. It would seem that halacha, that the rabbi, on first glance, would have to tell Chana, I'm sorry, you cannot call this child your own. So now that we've given you the laundry list of all the people that hold this, where do they get this from? Where are some of the sources that they pulled from? So we've seen the Yaldash Simcha B'Zakena. There's another fascinating source which is the agricultural law. There's another fascinating source that they try to pull this from. And this just comes to show you not how desperate we get, but how creative we had to be in order to come up with an answer. So if we look at the Pasuk in Bereishis and Perek Lamed, the Psukim go through and they say, Vatahar od Vatelet. When they're talking about all the daughters of Yaakov and the maidservants, so Leah, Bilhah, and Zilpah, about it says, Vatahar, they conceived, Vatelet, and they gave birth. And then all of a sudden, the pasuk changes, and it says, "Va'acha yolda bas v'tikra shema dina." It no longer says that she conceived, it just says, and then afterwards, she gave birth to a daughter. So, on the spot, the question is why? Why did we suddenly change what we were talking about? So, the Gemara in Brachos says the reason why is because Rachel thought to herself, Leah thought to herself, okay, I'm pregnant, and my sister's pregnant now. But there have already been 10 sons born, and we know there's only going to be 12. Therefore, if I have another son, my sister Leah is going to have fewer children, fewer male sons contributing to Klal Yisrael, to the Shvatim, than the maidservants. That can't be. So she davened, the Gemara says, what did she do? She davened. And look at the end of the Gemara in Brachos, what does it say? The last line, Miyad Nehefcha Labas. The male that was inside Leah switched and became a female. And that's the reason why it doesn't say Vatahir, because the child that Leah gave birth to was not the child that she conceived. It was a different gender. In this case, in this case, that's what happened. However, there's a fascinating medrash brought down the Targum Yonason that has a very different twist on the matter. It says, actually, when Leah davened, when Leah prayed, you know what happened? Read this inside. Ushmiya min kadam Hashem slusa de Leah. What did he do? V'ischalfu uvarya b'mehon. And he switched the ubar, the fetus switched between Rachel and Leah. V'havi yav Yosef b'masa de Rachel. And Yosef swapped into the womb of Rachel. V'dina b'masa de Leah. And Dina swapped into the womb of Leah. And that's the reason why the pasuk doesn't say Vatahir. Because it wasn't. It was a different person. A different fetus that was conceived inside Leah than what Leah gave birth to. And you can see here that finally we have a situation, we have what possibly a situation in which we've separated something that previously no one ever thought to separate. Conception and birth. And that's what we're doing, at least in an egg donation. Now it happens to be that at the end of the day, you know, we usually don't paskin halacha according to Medrash, especially when the Medrash is brought down differently in the Gemara Bavli. But it is definitely a fascinating source. The other source that is usually turned to are the Gemaras and Yevamos. There's two Gemaras and Yevamos on Daf Ayin Ches Amud Aleph and Amud Beis, and Daf Tzadi Zayin Amud Beis, which talk about converts and women who converted while she was pregnant. And each different, we're not going to go into these Gemaras because they are complex, but what's fascinating, right, as with most things, is that these are the Gemara sources for genetics versus birth. And you can look at them in your own time, or you can also listen to the shiur that we gave specifically on maternity and Jewish law. Fine. Going back to Chana. So now we have a basic general idea of some of the sources. We see that there's a laundry list of people. But one thing that we see is what were the options? Every time we ask, what are the answers that we get? Either it's the birth mother, or it's the genetic mother, or maybe it's both. Maybe even possible that there's none. But it's, for the most part, it's either the birth mother or the genetic mother. It's, the question has always been, when asking who is the mother, the question has always been, who is the biological mother? And unfortunately, that answer can sometimes, if let's say, the mother is the genetic mother, so Chana's, the answer to Chana is going to be, I'm sorry, this child is not your child. There was something about that that bothered me. Not because I don't agree, not because I have a problem with the halacha. No, the halacha is the halacha 100%. But I said, there's got to be something else that we can help Chana with. I felt this empathy, I felt so bad for that person, for Chana. There's got to be something. We have to help her out. She wants this child. Is there some way that Chana can call this her child? So it was this when I was sitting in my reproductive ethics class, when we learned, when I learned about the bioethical perspectives on maternity, that kind of opened the door to a different approach. So like I've said, the halachic discussions, we focused on two dimensions, the genetics or the birth, which is really just the biological definition of parenthood. But the bioethical world discusses an interesting case. The five-partner child. What do you mean the five-partner child? So let's say I have a couple, I have Jack and Jill, they're not brother and sister, they just happen to be named Jack and Jill, and they want to have a child. So what do? They go, they get an egg donor, they find a sperm donor, they even find a woman to carry the child, they find a gestational host, and they bring everything together, and they put this fertilized embryo into the gestational host. And then what happens? Unfortunately, when the gestational carrier is 12 weeks pregnant, Jack and Jill decide to get a divorce. And this child that's growing here in this gestational host, it's just too painful of a reminder of their marriage. Neither one of them want to have anything to do with this child. So now this case comes before the judges. I have a picture here of some very English-looking judges, actually. But, right? Now, why does it come before the judges? Because, you know, unlike philosophers, or anyone else who discusses and writes about it, you know, philosophers can hear the case, they can read about the case, they can even write a whole, go and say, wow, you know, this is really complex, this is a really fascinating case, I'm ready to go home. I don't know the answer. They can say that. But the judge, when the judge is sitting on the bench, the judge can't be like, well, you know, it's really interesting, it's really fascinating, but I got dinner waiting for me at home. It's too hard for me to answer. No, the judge has to give an answer. So what does the judge do if there's no legal precedence, or there's not a strong legal precedence? So sometimes they will turn to the philosopher's writings on the topic. So let's take a look at some of the philosophical writers. So the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy has a great discussion of what makes someone a parent. What are the grounds for parenthood? And of course, they discuss the usual, the genetics, and the gestational, but they add two more. They add intentionality. Intentionality. What does intentionality mean? So what is, they say that carefully and intentionally orchestrating the procreational act, bringing together all the necessary components with the intention of creating a unique individual whom they intend to raise as their own. So what did the intentionalists just say? Is that parenthood is fundamentally a moral relationship. And not necessarily a biological relationship. I don't have to be biologically related as long as I carefully and intentionally cause this to happen. It's my child. And because it intended this to happen for the purposes of me raising this child. So in the case of the five-partner child, according to this perspective, intentionality, it would be these two, Jack and Jill, would be the parents. Now, just to give an example of intentionality, so let's say it would go even the other way. So let's say, unfortunately, let's say Jack's sperm got mixed up in the bank and went to some other random woman. I don't know, let's say Jacqueline. Jack and Jacqueline. Jacqueline's sperm. Jacqueline gets inseminated with Jack's sperm, unknowing, never wanted it to happen. It was a mistake that happened in the lab. That's why you should always have a mashkicha watching over this. Now, would you say that Jack is the father of this child? He was a biologic contributor, and the answer that the intentionalists would say is no, because it was not their intent. And this is a little bit of a radical idea. I'll give you that. This intentionality concept is radical. But what it does for us is it opens the door to the idea that parenthood doesn't have to only be defined by a biological relationship. And then the second model that they use is something called causality. Causality, in its pure form, is just that if I've caused this child to exist, that's sufficient for generating parental rights and responsibilities for that child. So it differs from intentionalism, because in the case of Jack and Jacqueline, Jack would be the child. Because he caused it to exist. Not because he wanted it, or he had intent to it, or he even knew it happened just because he caused it to exist. So now, with this account, the answer to who's the child in this five-partner child is no longer simply just one or two people. It's quite complex. In fact, it could even be all five. You can now have five parents. You thought halacha was crazy with two moms. We're coming up with five parents. What really happened here was it opened up my mind. That, like I said, you don't have to be biologically related to be called a parent. We see in the bioethical discussion this third dimension. This dimension of social parenthood. The parents that plan on raising the child. The social parents in this paradigm is considered the child. So today, what we hope to do is I wanted to know, I turned to Rabbi Sinensky and I said, does this social parenthood, does this have any basis in halacha? Does this third dimension have basis in halacha? Can we finally say to Chana, yes, this is your child because you are going to raise it, therefore it is yours. So with that, we turn to the next sources. So the next source I turn your attention to is the Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin. The Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin has a fascinating discussion, and what it says there, and I just brought, just to summarize the end, Lamedcha shekol megadol yasam besoch beso, malo alav hakosev ki'ilu yoldo. If you raise an orphan inside of your house, the pasuk considers it as if you gave birth to that child. That is like, it's as if you gave birth to this child that you raised. Now, this is a nice drush, but is there any halachic basis? Maybe you might say, this is really nice, that's cute, but this has no halachic basis. We don't see this anywhere else. We don't see this actually brought down in halacha. However, there are several indications and proofs that this might not be just homiletical. So I turn your attention now to the Gemara in Kedusha. The Gemara in Kedusha, where Abaye says, Abaye throughout Shas refers to his mother. And he says, Amra li aim. My mother said this, my mother said that. However, Abaye was a yasam. Abaye's mother died right at the beginning of his life. So how is he saying, Amra li aim? My mother told me this. He wasn't even alive for his mother to have told him this. His mother wasn't even alive when he was old enough. How could he possibly say Amr li aim? So what does the Gemara say? Why? Hahi meravinsa havi. Zak Rashi, what does the word meravinsa mean? When Abaye says aim, who is he referring to? Meravinsi umanas. He's referring to the nurse that took care of him. The person that raised him, that's who Abaye refers to as his parent. So still, okay, the Meinekes, his nurse wife, he's referring to as a mother. So that still might be nice. But it's now another place where we're seeing this concept. Now, is there any source for this in the Torah? Does the Torah ever call someone because they raised them, their father or their mother, even though they didn't give birth to them? The answer is yes. You look in Parshas Pinchas in Bamidbar, Perek Chavav, Pasuk Mem Vav. The Pasuk says, V'shem Bas Asher Sarach. The name of Bas Asher was Sarach. There's a fascinating Ramban on this pasuk, which says that Sarach was not actually the daughter of Asher, but was in fact his stepdaughter. Haisa Bas Ishto, you see, Avo Haisa Bas Ishto mi Ish Acher, lo Hayelo Ben, Vaisa Nachlaso Lebito. Ulekach Amar, right? This, Sarach was actually from a previous marriage, was not Usher's daughter. However, so what does the Ramban say? The Ramban says, why was she called Shem Bas Usher Sarach? Lomer ki haya shema bas Usher v'nikras Sarach. Even though it wasn't by, even though Sarach was not biologically related to Asher, since Asher raised her, she's called Shem Bas Asher Sarach. She is referred to as the daughter of Asher. That's a powerful statement of the Ramban. Ramban is saying that the Torah itself says you raise the child can be called yours. But you might say to me, okay, still, I'm not convinced. There's another fascinating Gemara. The Gemara in Chulin, which is the next next Makar here, talks about a bird that takes care of another bird. An entire species differently. Nah, we're not talking about mankind anymore. Now we're talking about birds. And as you can see here, you got this little cute bird. So let's say this bird is sitting on an egg that's not its own, right? You can see the egg is the size of the mother bird, so it's probably not the same egg. It's probably not its egg. So, would the din of Shiluach HaKein apply here? Right? We have this whole fascinating topic of Shiluach HaKein, where you're supposed to send away the mother bird before taking the eggs. But what if the eggs do not actually belong to the mother? What if the mother is merely just raising the eggs, sitting on the eggs? Would we still consider that baby, that bird sitting on top of the egg, its mother? And the Gemara says, yes! That would be a situation, that would be a case in halacha where you would have the din of Shiluach HaKein. You would actually be required, or you have the mitzvah to send away, you're required to send away the mother bird. That would be considered the mother because it's trying to raise that child. Fascinating. So now we're starting to see that this drush, this nice idea, is finding its way into halacha. But that's with a bird. Are there halachic responses regarding raising of a child? So with this, we turn to the Shut Ramah. The Shut Ramah is a situation, basically, in Kuf Yud Ches. The Ramah was asked, can an adopted child recite Kaddish on behalf of an adopted parent? And he answers yes. And he says, he invokes the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Hamagad Yasim B'Seoch Beso Kila Yaldo. Now, you might say, okay, you know, that's nice, but that's not such a big deal. You know, anyone can say Kaddish for anyone. Okay, fine. But we're seeing another case where he invokes this Gemara and uses this Gemara in some way, lahalacha. So turn your page to page 5. Page 5 has a Tshuvos Maimoni, in Sefer Mishpatim. It's found in the back of the Frankel Rambam. And the question here is regarding shtaros. If, right, in a shtar, we usually identify, when we're writing a shtar, we identify the person in the shtar by their parents' name, right? We'll say, Yona ben Shmuel. What if, in this legal document, I identify it as ben Hamigadol? So I write Yona, the son of whoever raised him. I write Chaim ben Shmerel, even though Shmerel was the one who raised him. So it's not the legally biological father, but I use the social parent in this case. Would the shtar be good? And what does he say? What does the Tshuvos Maimoni say? It would be. And this, you might say, okay, fine, but that's not codified in halacha. But it is codified in halacha. You take a look at the Ramah in Choshen Mishpat. He says, Mishim Egadol Yasim B'Soch Besu V'Kasev Alav Shtar. If I raise a child in my house, and in a shtar I write it as Bini as my son, or the Yasom writes that his father or mother is the person that raised him, is the social parent, Lo Mikri Mizuyef, it's not considered a false shtar. Kasha Arayel, the kosher, and it's a kosher shtar, since hoyol v'gadluhu, since he raised him, roi l'kasov l'cha, l'kasov kach. Halachically, it's completely permissible for the father to call this his son, or for the son to call the social parent his father. And the Gra on the spot there refers us back to Mishnah Megadol. He refers us back to this Gemara in Sanhedrin that we saw. So now we're starting to see that in Halacha as well, in actual Psak, we can say, we can start calling people, the social parents, your actual parents. Then we have a fascinating Chachma Shlomo. Chachma Shlomo, Rav Shlomo Kluger, written at the bottom of the Shulchan Aruch, he has a fascinating discussion. And what he says there is a discussion of whether I could be Mekayim Pru Revu. Can I be Mekayim the Mitzvah? So now this is a step further. This is not just maybe referring to halachically being allowed to refer to this person as my parent. Is the Megadol, is the social parent, can that social parent be Mekayim the Mitzvah of Pru Revu? And he says, I had a question. Someone who raises a yasam v'yasoma b'soch beso im nechshar zekiyim pru revu. Since Chazal say kol megadol yasam v'yasoma b'soch beso, that if you raise it, ma'al avakasov kilu yaldo. He asks, so can you mekayim pru revu? And he has a very interesting discussion, which we're not going to get into, but he wants to know, can we use this lahalacha? And he says, maybe. Maybe that raising a child can be a way in which you're Mekayim the Mitzvah of Pru Revu. He has a whole discussion about whether you also need to give birth to a child separately than this child. We're not going to get into that because that's a lot more complicated. But the point is that he opens that. He uses the Gemara in Sanhedrin and says, will this Gemara in Sanhedrin go even as far as to say that I can be Mekayim Pru Revu? And he says it's possible. It is possible. Next, we have the Birchas Banim. The Birchas Banim is, he quotes this Chachmas Shlomo, and he rejects it completely. He says, no, absolutely, you need to have a biological relationship in order to be Mekayim Pru Revu. He says, Rav Shlomo Kluger is a Das Yachid. Rejected lahalacha. However, interestingly enough, if you take a look next in the Tzitz Eliezer actually refers to this Chachma Shlomo and actually says, "I wonder. I don't know. I wonder if I can be Mekayim the Mitzvah of Pru Revu, because the pasuk says, because the Gemara says, 'Megal Yosam v'Yosam b'Soch Beso.'" Malo lava kasev ki'ilu yaldo. What do we say ki'ilu means? Does ki'ilu mean that it actually is? Or it's just a nice concept? So he actually quotes this Chachma Shlomo as part of his discussion. So obviously he feels that this Chachma Shlomo is not that far out in left field. While he might not agree with it, but he thinks it's not that crazy to bring into this halachic discussion. Okay, so we've seen this idea that maybe we can call the social parent, the mother, the parent, that even in halacha, in shtaros, it can be used as that, you can call that your parent. And possibly, according to some shitas, it might be even possible to be mekayim the mitzvah of Pru Revu by raising this child. So I want to end with a fascinating Shemos Rabbah in the end of Perek Memvav. The Shemos Rabbah goes a step further. And he says, in the underlined words here, he says, he's quoting that, says Ella Oscha Shahamegadil Nikra Av Volo Hamolid. Oscha Shahamegadil, you, the person that raised the child, Nikra Av. That's considered the father. Volo Hamolid. Not the person that gave birth to the child. The person that raised the child. The person that was involved in the social raising of the child. Completely twisted around. It says that the biological relationship is irrelevant if there's no rearing of the child. If you're not being the megadol, if you're not being the raising, not even called the father. He throws it out the door. Fascinating. Unbelievably fascinating, Shmuel's Rabbah. And we will finish with Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik, in his essay in Family Redeemed, he also talks about this. He discusses that there are two aspects to parenthood. And he's talking about the childless mother and father that must reconcile themselves with the fact of natural barrenness and sterility. But he says they can attain the full covenantal experience of parenthood and exercise the fundamental right to have a child through adoption. And he says this new form of parenthood does not conflict with the biological relationship, but manifests itself in a new dimension, which can be separated from the natural one. So what you see here, we have Rav Soloveitchik writing that in fact, it's possible to say there is a third dimension of parenthood. Full covenantal. A third dimension in which parenthood exists. So even if I can't have a biological relationship, even if halacha will tell me you are not biologically related to this child, there still is another option, there still is another way for the child to be your child. It's fascinating. Unbelievably fascinating. And so here I would just like to summarize and conclude. So, based on everything that we've seen, would the bioethical principles of intentionality and causality, do they have any basis in Jewish law? Probably not. I don't think so. But what did those perspectives do? What did that help us do? It helped us step outside the quote-unquote halachic box and say, wait a second, let's look beyond the biological answer to maternity. We've been asking, in some ways, the wrong question. We keep saying, who is the biological parent? Who is the biological parent? But when Chana comes to you and asks you this question, the answer to that might not help her. We need to look deeper. We need to have empathy. So when Chana comes to the rabbi with this question, so what is our role? So I hope to be a physician. So what's my role as a physician, as a doctor, or as healthcare workers in this case, and beyond? So we as healthcare workers, we can share not only with our patients, but we can also share our knowledge, our perspectives, our readings in the bioethical world with the rabbinic leadership to offer this humane perspective. And it was this humane bioethical perspective that when I started discussing this with Rabbi Sininsky, we said, you know what? Let's take a different approach. Let's see if, in the end of the day, if we can help Chana. Chana wants this to be her child. She wants me to call this her child. And all we have seen today has yielded us a new philosophical perspective, albeit not necessarily halachic, on the nature of parenting. That there are two aspects. There's the biological, as well as the educational raising of the child. Meaning that the one who raised the child can be considered the mother. And now when Chana comes to you and asks, please let this be my child, you can give her a resounding yes, this is your child. Okay, it might not be your child from the Yerusha aspect. They might not automatically inherit you. Because yes, there are different, there's different dimensions of parenthood. Certain dimensions of parenthood give you certain rights. Other dimensions of parenthood give you other rights. But still, this is your child. And I believe that this humane side, the side that bothered me when I first went through the sugya, is something that I honed here at Einstein. Because that's something that we do here at Einstein. We look at the humane side of medicine. But there's something that being a part of the Einstein Jewish community allowed me to go a step further. Not only was I able to recognize this humane perspective, I was able to work and find a way that maybe halacha can offer the same humane perspective. Because that's really what we do here at Einstein, and for the Einstein Synagogue community, this really is science and Torah at the heart of medicine. I thank you all for coming, and we will entertain questions in a moment. Thank you.